Hits 106, Greatest Hits Radio. Good morning, I'm Marvelous Marvin. Coming up Friday night, the 26th, at the Capitol Theater, 8 o'clock. A legendary comedian, the guy who sort of changed the way that we look at the world and laugh. And I could talk about him forever, how much I love Robert Klein. But I'll just say this, he's the only person I've ever interviewed that has seen Yogi Berra's and Rodney Dangerfield's testicles. Good morning, Robert.
That is true, actually. Statistically, the chances of that. Mr. Boone, may I call you Marvelous?
You can call me anything you like, Robert.
Right.
Absolutely.
Isn't that something, you know, that Yogi is one of my great heroes, a great American story, immigrant, child of immigrants on the Hill in St. Louis. And I was credentialed to do the 77 All-Star Game for Sport Magazine to write an article about it at Yankee Stadium, and I got into the clubhouse. I've been a fan since I'm 5 years old, and there's Yogi Berra, and he happens to be naked. With a Chesterfield in his mouth. And I tell you, gravity plays a tremendous part in the human condition after a certain age. And Rodney, of course, you know, he is actually my Yale Drama School for comedy. In the early years, we were extremely close, for about 10 or 11 intense years. Rodney had a habit of sitting in his bathrobe, and he was... He was not particularly modest. So that's a four testicle parlay right there.
I think you're the only person on earth that can say that, Robert.
You actually brought those two things together.
I feel bad about it, as a matter of fact. But you know, in your comedy upbringing in New York City, you got to work out and hang with people like Richard Pryor and Bette Midler and, of course, Rodney Dangerfield. And I love W.C. Fields. I know you love the old comedians and great comedians.
Oh, I love.
And to me, in a way, Rodney was sort of the successor to W.C. Fields in that, you know, most the celebrities have all these publicists to make them look great. And W.C. Fields, his trademarks are hating kids and being a drunk and hating women, too, basically. Those are his trademarks. And Rodney sort of was the same thing. He just decided that was his character. He was just going to be that. And I love that.
Well, he was every man. You know, he was every man. You know, I'll tell you, you can always tow my car. It's always on the lift, you know. But it's true that these, Lee Solomon, who was head of nightclubs at William Morris, said, you got to wear a tux. He didn't get it at first that he was every man, you know. And I learned a lot from him because at the beginning he was an incredible joke writer. And in his youth, he had spent a lot of time with Lenny Bruce and Joe Ansis, who sold aluminum siding, and Georgie Starr. And these were all comedians, of course. And but as far as the oldies are concerned, I love Fields stuff. I have a big photo in my kitchen of him in profile next to John Barrymore.
Oh, yeah, they were great drinking buddies, yeah.
And how. I mean, you know, the drinking part was, I mean, I saw some unretouched Paramount publicity photos without makeup and all. I mean, the blood was coming out of his pores. His entire body was a wreck. But I love the Marx Brothers. I love Laurel and Hardy. I bet you're a Laurel and Hardy fan.
Oh, are you kidding me? I could watch them all day long. And Buster Keaton. And here's the thing I love about Buster Keaton and W.C. Fields in particular, and Laurel and Hardy and Charlie Chaplin. You can watch those films 100 times, and you'll see something that you never saw. Especially W.C. Fields did so many subtle things with his little voice or just a little tiny motion and action. And the same with all those greats. It's like there's just so much there.
Had a nice correspondence with his grandson Ronald. I like to think that while he was not a perfect person, this the kind of subtlety he performed. I don't know how well it would go today. I think there's very little subtle today. I mean, there's a lot of funny people, but it's a kind of anything goes mentality. You know, I think Lenny Bruce, who was kind of crucified. Almost literally couldn't work and everything. If you listen to his stuff now, it's so, you know, mild and intelligent in its way. I profanity is important when it's used as part of the language, like a good writer would.
Like Richard Pryor. You know, you use it for certain things.
And like, I give him a pass. Go ahead. What were you going to say about
him? Roger, Richard, and, you know, the thing is, I meant that he did it the right way. And again, it goes back to the thing, nothing is mean if it's funny enough. If it's funny enough, then you pretty much...
You could be funny about it. You could talk about any subject. I mean, the concentration camp population had their own sense of humor. American slaves, Irish in general, have a tremendous sense of humor. It comes from centuries of oppression. Humor is a kind of a release. Pryor had a career on Merv Griffin. He was collegiate with sweaters. He was clean. He was hilarious. But then he disappeared around 68, 69, about a year and a half, and he came back as a more authentic. When I met him at the Improv in New York, I asked him what college he went to. We had long ago, he laughed for 5 minutes. He was brought up in a brothel. So he became a more authentic comedian. And it was, of course, raunchy and profane, but at least he backed it up with the real thing.
Listen, you know? It was...
I just also, it's a style, too. Yeah. George was a wonderful comedian, George Carlin. I just thought, you know, he was too dark at times and too profane.
Yeah, I think near the end of his life, he got real nihilistic near the end of his life, and it was kind of
very but
it was
suicide
but it was,
and blah blah blah.
But it was so genius though that in a way you could hang in there, kind of like Kurt Vonnegut. Kurt Vonnegut would make you laugh, the author Kurt Vonnegut, but then at the end of the book you were depressed, even though you laughed for 2 hours. It kind of same.
He was another
George
one
Carlin.
Too. I spent fair amount of time with Vonnegut, and I loved his book. And he was a very gentle soul, you know, having been in the air raid at Dresden when he was a prisoner of war. I think it changed his life a lot. But George's daughter, Kelly, I'm in contact with her, too, and she has a new book out. It was not easy being a child of George and his wife, Brenda. They were both, you know, there are a lot of drugs and a lot of stuff that does not comport with having a child. Boy, this is serious. I want people to know when I'm at the Capitol Theater, I'll be funnier than this.
Yeah, what is a child of the 50s going to be talking about? I want to know.
You know your stuff, Marvelous.
I'm a fan. What can I say? I don't know much. But I know what I love. It affects me. And like I say, you know, when David Bowie died, when Frank Zappa died, it affected me. I wondered why, and then I realized that they were talking to the outsiders. And your kind of comedy, when it started, you were talking to the outsiders. It wasn't jokes. It wasn't Henny Youngman. It was talking to us. And the people that touch you that way, it makes an impression on you, and it never leaves. And I feel that way about you.
Well, you know, that's true. I like my son took a film course at the University of Vermont. He was going to see Citizen Kane. I said, you're not going to be as wowed by some of the effects, camera effects and the lighting and all that, because everybody's copied it. When I first did The Tonight Show in January of 68, January 19th, 1968, they actually had me sit as a complete unknown on the panel with Johnny for a couple of minutes because they figured what I'm doing is so different, kind of strange. They wanted the audience to get to know me for a minute or two. It was a terrible plan. I bombed to the minute sitting with two. Johnny got up and killed him in the stand-up. But it is true. I wanted to bring the language, some intelligence. I love silliness. I mean, I could climb on the piano, but I love stuff that's thoughtful. I was very much influenced by my most influential comedians were Jonathan Winters, who was a genius. I spoke at his memorial last year.
I like what he said. He was asked about what's it like getting older. He says that you're a flashlight getting dimmer. I love that.
Yeah, I mean, you look it up in a Green Room episode with Paul Provenza on Showtime. He was there with me and Paul, and I forgot who else. He was so funny that his body was a wreck. It took him about 5 minutes to sit down, you know, and I saw the same with Rickles. I did something with him last year. He's quick as can be. He's brilliant, too. The other great influence was Lenny Bruce, because he not only did this kind of, you know, voices and characters like Jonathan did. Jonathan was completely apolitical, but in his humor is, I mean, there's a session he did with Carson about how his father was drunk on Christmas Eve and how cold his parents were. He went to the Marines in World War II. He was in combat in the South Pacific. He came back, and where's all his airplanes and his toys and his junk? His mother said, well, I gave them away. He said, gave them away? She said, well, I wasn't sure if you were coming back.
That sums up comedy right there. It's a defense mechanism. Well, it's a way to survive, and it's I like what Carlos Santana says. He says comedian are holy men, and he says a really good belly laugh is better than a month of meditating, and that's what we're going to get. Not meditating, but lots of laughs with you, Robert Klein, Friday night, the Capitol Theater, the 26th. I said you don't need to be funny here because this is free. But when people pay to see Robert Klein...
No, but I mean, I love performing in person. I'm as good as I have ever been at it. Bob Stein, my accompanist, is coming. We're going to do the colonoscopy song, which was nominated for a Primetime Emmy, by the way. It'll be great. It's a wonderful venue. I'm glad that it isn't a parking lot, that the community saved it.
Exactly.
And I haven't been there, but I understand it's a beautiful theater.
Robert Klein, Friday night, the 26th, Capitol Theater, downtown Clearwater, 8 o'clock. We need to laugh. This is the place. Robert Klein, it's an honor talking to you, and thank you very much.
Hey, it's really great. You're a real character, and if you can make it there, I'd love to meet you.
I'm going to be there. I'm going to be sitting there checking it out and enjoying myself, and just it's going to be fantastic.
Well, if you come, I really would love to meet you. You sound like... we could talk comedy forever, you know, anyway, but thanks for the plug, and it was really a pleasure. You really know your stuff.
It's from the heart. And yes,
how old are you, may I ask?
I just turned 60, so I was born in 55.
I just turned 74. Where are you from?
I was born in West Virginia. Maybe you can tell by my accent. So it's funny, I'm an undercover hillbilly. People, my relatives are.
Oh, really? You have the radio timber.
Was a DJ in 1950. Until 55, so I sort of inherited this voice, but he got
what
out of
did he play?
Here's the thing. He played before 55, there was no rock and roll on the radio for white people, so he played all the big band stuff. But then when rock and roll came in, the year I was born, he goes, I can't play this blank, and he became a newsman the rest of his career. And TV and radio, Cleveland, Ohio, and this and that, but a lot of times he worked at rock and roll stations, so I got in Cleveland, Ohio, I got a hell of a...
Alan Freed started there.
Yeah, Alan Freed, and I got to know Alan Freed's son-in-law, real son of a bitch, stole Alan's records. Anyway, I would love to talk to you again sometime.
One quick thing I'll tell you. Alan Freed had a show on WINS in New York called The Moondog Show. And he played stuff like the earliest stuff, Mickey and Sylvia, Love is Strange, and The Crows, G, do you know any of those songs?
Oh, please, you're talking to Rock and Roll Disc Jockey.
Yeah, real early.
He played Big Al Sears.
Big Al Sears.
I love Big Al Sears.
Man, but played all those solos.
Tiny Bradshaw, all that good stuff.
And anyway, it was a lot of the music was crossover, kind of gospel. Anyway, he had a show called Moondog Show, and there was a character that used to dress as a Viking and stand in front of the CBS building over here on 6th Avenue.
I've got his album. He's on Columbia Records, same label as Bob Dylan and Miles Davis.
Moondog?
Yeah, he put out two albums.
Reading his poetry, right?
Yeah, with the little jazz music in the background.
And he was blind. He was a blind Viking poet, and he had these groupies from Sarah Lawrence and